Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 555th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta.
And today, we've invited Jamie Fault back, who's been on a number of podcasts, one I think just a few months ago, to talk about a really interesting question that, as with our previous podcast, I do not believe we even touched on this topic, and you guys might figure it out why we haven't. But I think it's a really good one, and it's a really interesting one to look at from the perspective of evidence and all that sort of stuff. So welcome, Jamie. Maybe you could just introduce who you are again.
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Always exciting to be on the show. So I'm an associate professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of Manitoba, and I practice as a clinical pharmacist in family medicine.
So why don't you let everyone know what's the clinical question where you guys tried to answer with this TFP and maybe even where it came from?
Right. So the question that we were looking to answer was whether using low-dose aspirin would be effective in preventing complications in pregnant women who are at risk of preeclampsia. And where that came from was family physicians hearing more and more about aspirin and maybe not being completely sure if they're supposed to be using it for pregnant women, which pregnant women, or is it all of them? Yeah.
Yeah. And so what was the basic clinical question?
Right. So if we use aspirin on a daily basis in low doses, can we prevent preeclampsia and other complications that would come along with that, like things like preterm birth, perinatal death being probably the biggest of those? And are we, in doing so, are we risking anything? And with ASA, that usually involves bleeding risk of some kind.
Yeah, so you guys did a whole evidence review trying to figure this out because there are a fair number of RCTs that have looked at this. And why don't you sort of go over what evidence you guys found?
Sure. Yeah, there are lots of systematic reviews. And we just took it back about 5 years. And even within that, we found 7 systematic reviews that helped us answer our question. And we're looking at anywhere from about 16 or 17 RCTs in one of our systematic reviews up to 77 RCTs. So we're looking up to close to actually 50,000 patients in the biggest systematic reviews that we found.
Which is quite something. But again, we always let people know, if you are studying that many people, you're probably looking not for a huge absolute difference, but nonetheless, it's at least we'll get a good view of where it stands from a benefit and harms perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And the findings show just that. And most of these had the primary outcome as preeclampsia. That was the big question. And what we found was that fairly consistently, about 15 to 30% relative reduction in preeclampsia was found. It came to about a 2% absolute difference when they compared it to women being on placebo.
And so what were the sort of absolute numbers that you're talking about?
Yeah, so we're looking at in the aspirin group, rates of preeclampsia somewhere between 5 and 10%. And then in the control group, somewhere between 6 and 12%. Right. So like you said, we're talking about small numbers, but a fairly reasonable outcome being preeclampsia to give you a number needed to treat somewhere in the ballpark of 50.
Yeah, nice. And that's, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but that's using ASA daily for starting usually at around at the end of 3 months.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So again, looking back at the RCTs that were included, the vast majority would be somewhere, they would have started somewhere between 12 and 30 weeks generally. There were, I think, three or four that started slightly before 12 weeks. But when we're talking about this many RCTs, we're talking about, you know, probably 40 or so where they had that tighter range. A lot of them in between 12 and 20 weeks, but some of them were extending them out to even up to 32 weeks in some areas.
Okay. And so it showed about a 2% preeclampsia absolute benefit, but there are a bunch of other outcomes that are really crucial, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So placental abruption was another one that was looked at in multiple systematic reviews and weren't able to find a difference in placental abruption, but that was one of the few things where differences weren't found. So preterm delivery, birth, in two systematic reviews, it was actually reported in a couple of others, but two systematic reviews gave us the basis of the most comprehensive data that was available. And what that showed was a reduction, again, by about somewhere in the ballpark of 2% absolute for preterm delivery. And then, as I said, when we look at perinatal death, again, three systematic reviews gave us very consistent reductions in perinatal death. Now, as you can imagine, we're not looking at big differences, and it turned out to be about a 0.5% absolute benefit in perinatal death. So about a number needed to treat in the ballpark of 200. That was a relative risk of about 10 to 20% that amounted to about 0.5%. But again, when we're talking about death, we're usually willing to accept smaller numbers.
Yeah, no, for sure.
This is something, you know, it's fascinating when you think about it, that when you, as you said, Jamie, 0.5% doesn't sound like a big number, but this outcome, I can't imagine too many families and mums not picking to take aspirin to reduce it by 0.5%, knowing that the baseline risk is somewhere around 2 to 3% in these studies to get it even down more. Like they would, almost anyone would pick that. Like this outcome is so powerful that even 0.5% is a big number just because of how important it is.
Yeah. And we'll get sort of to the population because that's a very important distinction of who you should be considering for this. But I don't think there are any other benefits, right, Jamie?
Those are the key ones. And if you sort through the systematic reviews, you might find scattered other things that were reported, but those were the big ones for sure. Yeah.
And then what about the harm? So you know, as we know, if a drug without side effects is a drug without an effect. So
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So postpartum hemorrhage was by far the most commonly studied outcome. So varying definitions of what that meant, but generally, it was either having greater than 500 mils of blood loss, up to 1,000 or more mils of blood loss. Some of them said, as long as you had blood loss that could be counted and the patient was symptomatic for blood loss. So a variety of things, but fairly consistent. And three out of four of the systematic reviews found a difference in postpartum hemorrhage, but it was actually in the magnitude of about 1% absolute increase in the three out of the four that found that difference.
And then they did look for anything to do with negative fetal outcomes, and I don't think they found anything.
Right. Yeah. So just one systematic review looked at that, and that involved six RCTs that evaluated that outcome, and they weren't able to find any statistical difference. And one of the things that we found, and we wanted to be open to observational data, of course, is that there is a, and as you probably know, the Swedish data registries are pretty massive. And so they were able to collect data for over 300,000 women. And of those, about 4,000 or so were on aspirin. And so they took that cohort and found a very tiny 0.06% increase associated with use of ASA. But again, knowing all the confounders that are within observational data, even with the many adjustments they do, we don't know if this is actually a real finding or not. And keeping in mind that the RCTs were looking at thousands of patients as well. So you'd think they would have picked it up.
Right.
But we wanted to do that just to make sure that we were covering our bases for intracranial bleed, which is a fairly significant fetal outcome.
Yeah, but no, it's a good point with what you bring up. I mean, if you don't pick it up with looking at, you know, upwards of 30 to 40,000 people, it would have to be, again, a very small risk for the same reasons where we talked about the absolute differences here of benefit are relatively small. But as Mike, I think, very appropriately points out, if it is real, and I think it likely is, a 0.5% reduction in perinatal death, that's fairly impressive for a pretty innocuous treatment. I think both of you guys would agree.
Yeah, for sure.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Aspirin a day is it doesn't get much simpler than that.
I don't think. No, for sure. Yeah, and even from a cost perspective. But what were some of the sort of limitations of the evidence?
Yeah, so this was when you mentioned this before, James, looking at what defines a patient that is at risk of preeclampsia. Mm-hmm. And pretty early on in looking at this, we realized that there were a lot of phrases that were used, like women at increased risk or women at high risk or women at highest risk. Mm-hmm. And so it took a lot of digging to find out what that meant. And all of that digging led to us realizing it's a bit of a dog's breakfast of what that actually meant. Yeah. If you look at what our national guidelines, the Canadian guidelines and the American guidelines say, they would look at a high risk factor for preeclampsia as being something like obviously having preeclampsia in a previous birth, mm-hmm. chronic hypertension, diabetes, chronic kidney disease. And if you have one of those, you're high risk. And that would make perfect sense. Or you could have at least two moderate risk factors. And that could be that this is your first pregnancy. If you're 35 to 40 years or older, if you've had previous complications in pregnancy. And so you can imagine a 38-year-old woman that's having a baby for the first time. She would meet those criteria. And when you think about it in that context and look at all of the RCTs that are out there, and although they vary in who they allowed in, you probably have it covered when you look at those kind of criteria, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. Because I tried to find even some numbers myself, and I found that, you know, if you look at all births overall, the chance of preeclampsia is roughly 5%. And then actually having eclampsia is about 0.3%. So those are the numbers, which is, you know, if those numbers, if they are that small, it makes sense that you'd want to get people who are at higher risk. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the context. But Mike, because I know both Jamie and I were talking about, we don't have tons of clinical experience with this. What's been your take on this over the years?
Well, we certainly weren't doing this regularly or thinking about it enough, I guess. Mm-hmm. And when I started work at the college, we were doing a antenatal course. And I remember being in a room with the people who have focused practice, delivering a lot of babies, et cetera. And the question came up, like, what are the key things we want family doctors to know about that's evolving and important? And I remember this either was number one or in the top three, mm-hmm. that they felt that the thing that we were missing and a lot of people were missing is the importance of this simple intervention for potentially really important outcomes. And then right around the same time, the U.S. task force came out with recommendations around it. I think probably one of these systematic reviews is from them, Jamie. Yep. And it just really struck me how much these people who've dedicated their lives to delivering babies and taking care of pregnant moms, how much they valued the importance of this. So I can only say that I think that most people, it is something that we need to know about. And when I saw Jamie was doing this Tools for Practice with his team, I was very happy to see it coming down the pipe because we needed to do one. And I was about to propose it to the peer group when I saw Jamie was already working on it. So we were fortunate.
And I think that, you know, the biggest concern and, you know, I have some experience in this area, and I'm sure you guys do as well. One of the biggest issues is, you know, taking any medications when you're pregnant is always a concern. But I think in this case, you know, the biggest concern of almost any medication that you're taking is in the first 3 months of pregnancy. So none of that really applies here.
Yeah, it doesn't apply here. And it's also like you always, as you know, you look at the costs and benefits and what happens if you don't treat. And we have RCTs. This is like, how often, we have to be honest, how often in the care of pregnancy do we have RCTs of a drug intervention of this number? It's like 30 to 50,000. It's just, you know, it's so rare. So this is probably some of the most robust evidence we'll ever muster.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, some of the, as far as the question again, you know, is sometimes so if we just apply it to high risk people, then that's great. And I think, again, our guidelines have probably given us some reasonable guidance on who to choose.
Yeah.
And they're upfront about saying that our sensitivity using that criteria is pretty low. But I think it's reasonable to go on, and systematic reviews are not completely clear. Certainly in high risk, we see the benefit is there. And when they look at subgroups that are general population pregnancy, it's the data is a lot more unstable. And we don't have a lot of RCTs that looked at the lowest risk patients. And so it's difficult to draw conclusions about that. But I think we probably have some reasonable guidance on that.
Yeah. Now there's a whole bunch of other sort of context, right, with regards to doses and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And that was probably one of the things that we had to spend the most time chatting about as a group, was how we land on this. And from a dose standpoint, if you look at some of our guidelines, if you look at the American guidelines, they will suggest that women go on 81 milligrams. If you look at the Canadians, they'll say 81 to 162, so one or two ASA, and the NICE guidelines say 75 to 150 because they use those doses. When we looked at this, it was really all over the place. When you look at systematic reviews, would often break it down into less than 100 milligrams or greater than 100 milligrams, and you could see maybe some trends in one systematic review, and then you would look and you'd see, but when they divided it as 75 milligrams or more or less, you found exactly the same trend, meaning it, you know, you can draw that line in multiple places. But where we landed was, if 81 milligrams is kind of on the right side of those risks, even though they didn't show statistically any difference in those subgroups, which is always hard to do with any reliability, we just found that 81 still lands in the right place in most of the systematic reviews, if that, you know, rings to how you'd understand it.
Yeah. And we know that 81 is called a baby aspirin, so there you go.
That's right.
Nice, Dave. And how far ahead of the podcast have you?
Well, I like to be very honest. I literally just came up with that. I'm looking at that going, that's a fascinating play on words. Normally these sort of comments do take months and months.
True.
Yeah. But this was just so freaking obvious. I actually was waiting for you guys to have said it, but you didn't.
We wanted to leave it for you.
Well, that's very kind of you. And here's what I always love. I have to love Canadians to death. We always have to give ranges. We can't just say do this. We have to, they say 81 to 162. Well, how the heck is anyone supposed to figure that one out?
Well, I think, Jamie, if I'm not mistaken, the guideline said 81 to 62, 162, sorry.
Yes, sorry, A. Yeah, so, you know, it'd be, I see no reason why you wouldn't just go with, you know, a baby aspirin, but, you know, you could argue you take half of a regular aspirin or something like that. I don't think it matters, and probably just go with the least expensive. And we know that at least Mike, I'm going to talk about mechanism if you're okay with that.
Oh yeah, please.
Yeah.
I'm getting my pen and paper out.
Yeah, could you? Yeah, I'll draw a picture of that later on
and show it to the microphone.
Yeah. But you know, I think it works having something to do with platelets and the effect of aspirin on platelets is relatively irreversible. So the effect lasts a long time. So even if you miss a dose here or you miss a dose there, it really doesn't make any difference whatsoever. So I think, you know, this is a pretty easy thing to be using. Obviously, people need to make up their own mind. And, you know, maybe Jamie, you could go over what are the, I think you did talk a little bit about the guidelines, how they vary a bit, but what would be your sort of criteria for who should be at least offered this?
Yeah, I would go to what the guidelines suggest on this, because I think, like I said, that probably covers your bases mm-hmm. on whatever RCT defined as increased risk or high risk. And again, you can go to either of the American or the Canadian guidelines on this, and you'll find fairly consistent criteria. There'll be minor adjustments from one to the other, but a listing of high risk criteria, and one of those gets you into the ASA room, and two moderate risk factors. So as I mentioned before, those are usually pretty obvious, but tables are available on both of those guidelines, and I think that's probably the right way forward for this. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Mike.
I was just going to say, Jamie, I looked at this evidence too. I looked at I looked at the systematic reviews, then I pulled out the individual, what the RCTs were saying as what is increased risk. As you said, they were quite vague, but some of the RCTs did define it better. And if you then looked at the guidelines, that's pretty much exactly what they did. They just mirrored what were the common things used consistently across the RCTs. And so I think your recommendation is spot on. And that's what I think we ended up recommending in the antenatal course as well, that it's following the Canadian SOGC guidelines is quite reasonable, because their recommendations don't take a far trip away from what was actually done in the research studies.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing when you look at these guidelines as well is the Canadians are saying preferably start before 16 weeks. The Americans say somewhere between 12 and 28 weeks, so they're a lot broader than the Canadians. And this was another area where we had to really take a close look, and then realize that close look didn't really provide us much more than what we started with. But we've got four systematic reviews that did look at subgroups of whether you started before 16 weeks with the aspirin, or whether you started before 20 weeks. And before 16 weeks, again, doesn't mean starting at week one. It generally almost always meant 12 to 16 weeks. So you're starting at the early part of the second trimester. And three out of four of those systematic reviews, when you look at the outcome of preeclampsia, you could see that they suggest a possible enhancement of that reduction in preeclampsia if you initiate sometime before 16 to 20 weeks. But again, with subgroup analyses, it's really difficult. You get crossing over of your confidence intervals. It's not completely sure if there's a difference here and whether they're powered to do that. But if you wanted to, you know, make a call one way, and when I've looked at this, I've thought, how would I make this recommendation? I would say, if you can start it in the earlier part of the second trimester, that probably makes sense. None of the other outcomes that they looked at, they could find any kind of consistent correlation with starting earlier versus after 16 to 20 weeks. But it probably makes sense to think, well, if I'm putting this in my electronic health record as a reminder, it's probably a reminder for sometime before 16 to 20 weeks.
For sure.
And I think one of the other sort of on the flip side of it, if you will, I mean, if you are pregnant and you're, you know, under the age of, say, 35, and you literally have no other risk factors, that's not the population we're talking about.
No, you wouldn't be recommending it mm-hmm. in those patients right now. We don't have evidence to support
yeah.
that. And as Jamie said, I think the when you're looking at the normal population, normal in quotations, the people without these risk factors, the benefit is, even if it was real, it's so much reduced. So like there's really no, and all the harms would still stay. So yeah, it's really for this select population right now until the evidence changes.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, this has been really good. I think, you know, like I said, it's a simple intervention. You know, the absolute numbers aren't huge, but the outcomes are not great at all.
And that's, the numbers aren't huge, but the outcomes are huge.
Exactly. And that's, you know, just a great, it's a great example of how it's not just how big the effect is, it's what it is and all that. And also what are the harms and what are the costs and inconveniences. And like, I think you sort of intimated this, Jamie, you can't get much easier than a ASA tablet once a day for, you know, maybe 4 months or so, depending on when you start and when you stop, sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. No. Anything else you guys want to add, Mike or Jamie?
I am good, James. Thanks.
Yeah. Jamie, you're good.
I am good as well. Yeah. I really wished I had thought of the baby aspirin before you. But I have other things to do in my week than to think of.
We should mention just quickly who the other authors were, though.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I had two great PharmD students on research rotation with me, Sasha Kentwaru and Brianna DeRoche, mm-hmm. and a family physician that I comes from my hometown. She delivers a lot of babies in Steinbeck, Manitoba. Karen Tabes was also on our group.
Cool. Yeah, great stuff. Now, you guys did an excellent job. And because this is a tricky one, you got to get all the numbers and put it into context. So, no, super job. So, we'll just leave it at that. So, thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.